Welcome to Melanated ADHD. I'm your host, Annette. This podcast was created out of a genuine interest to profile and elevate BIPOC voices living with ADHD, with a special focus on Black and Brown women. By doing so, we look to reshape perceptions of how ADHD impacts our communities and explore pathways to flourish and thrive together. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the episode. So in order to understand who I am, I think it's best to go back to my childhood. And for some context, I am of Bajan Jamaican descent. I was born and raised in Canada, and my parents are from Barbados in Jamaica. They had split when I was younger, and so I was raised by my mother in a single-parent household, primarily in subsidized housing for my childhood and teenage years. A lot of the programs and services that I had access to in my earlier years were heavily subsidized by a number of charities and nonprofits. And so their involvement has very much shaped who I am as an adult today. If there's one word I could use to describe it, was very much music. That's the word that I would associate with my childhood, because everything revolved around music as a kid. I remember being in choirs. I remember being a part of a bunch of plays at school, at church, lip sync competitions, street festival competitions, doing musical theater camp, band camp, playing the flute and the clarinet, both in elementary school and in high school. And then at one point in time, I remember doing solo singing. And so I went through the levels of competitive singing and piano. Oh yeah, and piano. I can't believe I forgot piano. Piano was a major part of my life when I was a kid. And I think I was probably around age five when someone probably mentioned to my mom about the connection between music and mathematics. And so she just thought it was an opportunity for me to get exposed to that at an early age. And so I just kind of stuck with it. And I did music maybe like 3 or 4 times a week, in some shape or form, like either a lesson or a competition, all the way up until my early 20s. And so a lot of my earlier experiences in life was around the arts, so like around entertainment. And it was just something that I really enjoyed. I always wanted to be up front and center in these spaces and doing the things. I don't really remember how I went about memorizing a lot of the music and such. Maybe it was just me and the repetitiveness of the notes and the practices that I had to attend that helped with that. So I can't really speak to how I went about memorizing everything. But yeah, a lot of it was just around music. And even when I look at it from an academic standpoint, my grades are good. Like, I was in a lot of split classes, just so it gave me an opportunity to learn from the older grades. So, for example, when I was in grade 1, I was in a grade 1-2 split class. So then when I was done learning all the content that I could from a grade 1 level, I just learned grade 2 work. And I did that all the way up until high school. If anything, there was a couple of classes where it was just the single grade. I think it was grade 6 and grade 8. So a lot of split classes, a lot of opportunities for me to learn a bit more from my peers. And I know at one time I even did gifted testing and I did it. And they told me, nope, sorry, mom, your kid's not gifted. However, she did excel in mathematics, so I guess the music really paid off. But I just wanted to learn as much as I could, and I very much hold on to that same trait to this day. I'm like a sponge. I just want to learn as much as possible because I just wanted to be challenged, and school was not as challenging as it could have been for me, but I just kept it going. I just found other ways to challenge myself outside of school, which is pretty much why I liked music in the first place. And even when I talk to my mom about who I was as a kid and what she remembers about me as a child, She very much described me as someone who was just independent. I liked to play by myself. I had a big imagination, and playtime was the time where I guess I could shine. And so I remember one of my earlier memories of myself and my sister was that we used to put on these pretend cooking shows. Like, we would walk through our imaginary friends and audience members on how to go about cooking or baking whatever item that we just so happened to have in our kitchen at that time. And, you know, like, we're like 8, 10. So we're making like craft dinner and, you know, baking like the Betty Crocker cakes. But it was just something where we were able to just narrate and feel like we had the spotlight on us. But that's very much like some of my childhood memories and what I could recall about myself. But also something that I thought was fascinating that my mom had told me about in recent times was that she said that some of the comments that she would receive from teachers back in elementary school days was that I would never put my hand up to answer questions in class, even though I knew the answers. And I think that's like an important point to note from my childhood, because at that time, no, I didn't really understand what was going on. But I think it was an early indication of where I'm at today in understanding my ADHD. So from there, I went through elementary school. I went through high school. I didn't do as much music and I guess like acting in school, but I did still keep up with it outside of school. So I was in a competitive choir, and it was a soprano, alto, tenor, bass choir. So SATB, for those who know what I'm talking about. And we did festivals and competitions and performances throughout Ontario. So it was a thing that we did, and I loved it. And I did it for all the way up into my early 20s. You know, eventually I ended up going to university. And when I think even from like the shift from high school to university, it was a big jump for me, because with university, that's when the true struggles of, I guess, like the true ADHD symptoms came to light. Like, I've learned to mask a lot of the symptoms that I had when I was a kid. But it all came tumbling down, I guess you can say, in university. And so I ended up taking accounting, and I did it to just prove a point to my past teachers and a guidance counselor that, hey, I could do this hard subject, because they kept saying that, oh yeah, it was hard, and oh, you know, maybe you shouldn't do that, blah, 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 blah. You know what? Anyways, I was just determined to prove them wrong. So I took it. But I ended up switching into finance. Not to say that it was any easier. It was just as challenging. And what I never realized before until then, like at that point in time, was that I can't sit and listen and concentrate on people talking for a long period of time. Universities are notorious for having lectures for 3 hours at any given time. There were some professors who gave you a break. Some professors told you can monitor yourself because you're adults. But there was just no structure, like, consistently across the board. And I had to create that for myself. So there was no routines. There was no schedules. No one was hounding you for work. Maybe they would, on the occasion, tell you, hey, there's an upcoming midterm or an assignment that's due. But all of it was on you. Because everything was on you, usually you would default to your family and ask them questions. But I grew up in a single parent household with next to no family here in Canada, let alone them pursuing post-secondary education. And I was not having those knowledge sharing conversations around the dinner table. A lot of it I had to find out on my own through trial and error. And I didn't have anyone in my immediate circle who I could speak to, consult with. Growing up in Canada in the 1990s, early 2000s, there was maybe just shy of 500,000 people who were Black in Canada. And it's only in 2021 we reached 1.5 million people, which account for 4% of the population of Canada. So I didn't have that representation readily available to me. And also learning styles. there was no, I guess, like incorporation of different learning styles and, you know, different ways of teaching. It was very much like, you must listen to me talk about ANOVA and regression as part of my statistics classes or in my macro and microeconomics classes, just going through this material that sometimes can be dry. And I say sometimes it can be dry because some people may find it interesting. It's just, for me, it was not as interesting as it could have been. And so the only way I was able to get through those classes was by playing with Play-Doh in my hand. Sitting at the back of my classes where, you know, they had like 500 students that could sit in it and watch Robot Chicken off of my laptop. And I would have the subtitles on so then I can just follow along and then occasionally tune in and tune out of the lecture at the front of the room. And I would doodle. And I also recall even like times when I've missed transit just to get to school on time. And again, I just kind of associated that with me not knowing my place in terms of what my schedule is going to be like and establishing routines. And, you know, like I internalized a lot of that stuff. And even when I look back at like even my transcript, I retook a lot of classes because there were times that I literally walked out of the midterms and or final exams because I was just like, I'm done. I can't do this. It was so overwhelming. I remember this one experience where there was like 1,000 students who were writing all the same exam, probably different versions because that's what they do. They want to avoid cheating. But I remember just walking out. Like I was doing the multiple choice. I was trying to read all the questions and I just got so frustrated and I left. And because of that, it was reflected in my grades. And fun fact, it did not take me the standard 4 years to complete a bachelor's program. It took me 5 years. Why? Because I was suspended after the first year of university. Sorry, Mom, if this is the first time you're hearing about it. But honestly, it was just a lot. It was a lot to handle in my first year. Just the change of pace, the requirements that were put on you, and then no one necessarily, I guess, coaching you through it. A lot of it had to come at your own whim. And so in order to get back into the program, I had to prove that I was capable of doing the work. And so that involved, you know, going to a learning strategist where they can talk to you about different study strategies and ways to organize yourself and all sorts of things. And I learned a lot of great things out of that experience. Like I learned how to really utilize acronyms. I did a lot of color coding. Oh my gosh, I brought back the agenda, the use of an agenda. And I also incorporated Google Calendar because that was something that was up and coming in the early 2000s when I was going to school. And that's what I did. I just realized that maybe I just needed more time to kind of digest a lot of the information and perhaps I needed to take over classes again just to rehear, like to relearn the information for a second time because sometimes even the material was coming at me relatively quickly. So it even reminds me of the time when I wrote my HR designation exam and there was like two of them that I had to do. One was a common knowledge exam and then one was on employment law. And I never had to repeat any of them. Like I did well on those exams, but just the whole process of getting there and then sitting down and then reading over these questions over and over again, like the same line over and over again, it just brought me back to my university days. And I never really thought much about it. But again, these are all things to note for later as to why I got to the point where I got to. In university as well too, that was the first time I tried out counseling as in like therapy because that's what was suggested. They said, hey, maybe, you know, you just need to learn how to manage anxiety and, you know, like, you know, feelings of sadness or depression. And my first experience with counseling wasn't the greatest. Like the lady was very dismissive and it just felt like she didn't want to help me out. So I didn't touch therapy for a good 7 years. And it was only after 7 years that I even thought about trying it out again. Because again, I just reflected back on my university experience and then also just some of my work experiences to come to conclude that maybe there were some unresolved traumas that I needed to get through. And it was helpful because I learned great coping mechanisms and how to make improvements in some areas of my life, but I still struggled. And so when I think about work, like my work environment or even the relationships that I held, you know, romantically, friendship wise, whatever you want to call it, I realized I was just very process oriented. Like I either followed established processes in a workplace or I was creating them for myself. For myself, not plural. I'm not trying to pluralize. What I realized about myself in workspaces is that I either followed established processes to a T or I created them for myself. I realized that meetings would frustrate me, especially when there was no structure to them, because it would leave me in a place where I would have to talk about something or provide an opinion on something in the moment, and it would catch me off guard because I didn't have time to really digest the information for the first time that I've heard it and then respond. Like it just took me a little bit longer than most people, I feel. But again, I don't know. I don't know what I really attributed it to. I just felt a ways about it. And I just tried to, again, mask and find other ways that I could cope in order to speak up more in meetings. So I would take notes. I would paraphrase. So it give me a little bit of a buffer time to really respond with my own opinions and things of that nature. I just did little tricks here and there. And some of the things that I had done in my university years, like the color coding and the use of post-it notes, agendas, calendars, I just really utilize them to a T in my workspaces and in my relationships, because that was just the way I needed to process information and remember things. And those were the systems and processes that I had created for myself, and I just kept with it. And yeah, you know, I received comments here and there from people who either thought it was extreme or they thought it was weird, but you know what, it worked for me, so I just kept going on with it. And when I even reflect back on how people described me or even in workspaces, like everyone would say that, you know, they would tell me how smart I was and how and the ideas that I would bring forward were very innovative and, you know, just very out of the box like. However, in the same breath, they would also say that like I would make the stupidest mistakes on things and it would make me just question, like, do I really know what I'm doing? You know, that I make these little mistakes here and there. And I don't know, I just found myself, like, again, back in university, I would be running behind on different things. I'd forget things mid-sentence about what is it that I'm talking about. And I found myself more and more, you know, really embracing the fact that I needed to talk out loud to myself and write down things to remember what was told to me. And it's something that I do to this day, and I think I'll forever do. Just the concept of telling people that, hey, just a heads up, I like to talk to myself, and I will need to write this down, or else I will not remember. When I look at my friend groups as well, too, I realized that the show Friends, how they had a core group of friends? I never really had that, and I was very envious, And even when I look back now as I'm talking about it, I always had multiple circles of friends. Although I tried to have a core group of friends in high school and in university, it was just hard. And I realized that it just made me very exhausted to try. It was just very exhausting to try and keep up with everybody and their lives and such like that. Even to the point where like I was making notes on people and scheduling texts to people so then they would know that I remembered. It's so bad. But yeah, I am at a point where I was in the relationship that I'm still in now, but I just realized I wanted to make a change. I wanted to address some of these things that I had experienced and how what I was experiencing, how they impacted people, and then ultimately my partner. I wanted to address it, and I very much attributed it to trauma. And it was 2015 when I realized that I wanted to change stuff about myself, that it required a third party professional to walk me through some of the experiences that I held as a kid, as well as in my early adulthood. And that was when I tried out therapy again. And again, like I said, there was a lot of great things that I picked up in therapy, but it didn't cover everything. I still struggled and I learned a lot of great things in therapy, yet I still found I was always left with over 300 open tabs on my internet browser of things that I had read or had caught my interest, and I never did anything about it. So I did therapy for a few years, and again, like I said, nothing was really sticking in its entirety. Like, there were small changes in my life that there was a noticeable difference in. However, the fact still remains that I still struggled with that whole losing my train of thought mid-sentence. And I didn't know how to articulate it at that time, but I ended up going to my medical doctor because it was winter. What I realized in the winter, my vitamin D levels take a big hit and I would experience bouts of depression. And at that point in time, in January of 2020, I felt like I hit my lowest point out of all the times in the past. This felt the worst. And so I went to my medical doctor and I told her about how I was feeling, and I told her about, you know, all the things that I've been doing up to this date to try and address the issues from before, but nothing really stuck. And that's when she diagnosed me with depression, and it led to 4 years of being on antidepressants and a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. It was during this time, too, that I really started to reflect on my childhood, like the schools I went to, the environments I worked in, the people I've interacted with. Also, I couldn't ignore the blatant racially charged comments I'd see online and the underrepresentation in pretty much every space I was in. It was like every Black person I knew was going through this collective awakening where we all just started speaking up about our lived experiences, saying enough is enough. So during this period of time, I had to unlearn and relearn so much about myself, my family's heritage, and even Canada's history, especially how BIPOC communities have been treated throughout this country's turbulent past. Like, for example, from Indigenous residential day schools to Japanese internment camps and the discriminatory immigration policies that aligned with the Windrush era of Black immigrants coming to Canada. It was eye-opening to realize how deeply systemic racism still affects everything, even today. I'm saying all this because the events from 2020 to 2022 really opened my eyes. It pushed me to confront my own internalized traumas and helped me to connect with others who looked like me, whether in person or online. We were all navigating this new knowledge together, trying to better ourselves, if that makes any sense. But yeah, I just wasn't the same after all that. Therapy helped me process a lot of it. I was healing. But again, even with all that work, it felt like something was still missing. Like, I was still on antidepressants, and my doctor seemed to be okay with it. Really, it was the events of 2023 that became a turning point for me. The passing of my mother-in-law and what it meant to me and the family. And this was probably this was the closest death to me in my adult life that impacted me the most. Like, I knew this woman for 10 years of my adult life, and just her passing was very resemblant of the feelings and behaviors and things that I witnessed when my maternal grandmother passed away. And I didn't know how to handle it. And it was just the emotions were very intense for me at that point in time that I ended up taking a leave of absence from work for a good amount of time. And so during that time, I went through grief counseling. I was telling her about what I was experiencing at that time. I was telling her about how much my mother-in-law meant to me. And as part of that conversation, I talked about how my focus was off and my concentration was not there. And she prompted me to ask and say, like, you know, were these feelings that you always had, like, even before you were grieving? And I told her, yeah, you know, and I gave her some examples. I told her about how, ha ha ha, like, I would go and I would go and get tea, but then I would forget that, you know, there was something else that I need to get in the kitchen, and I would be distracted, and I would go and do this next and third. And then I would tell her about, like, how, you know, I would get a prompt, like an email would come through at work, and I would be in the middle of doing an assignment, like a project, but then it would take me a good 20 minutes to get back on track to get that flow of work back. It would just take me a long time. I was telling her about how it took so long for me to get back into the swing of things once someone interrupted my thought patterns. And I told her about how, you know, sometimes I would stumble mid-sentence and such like that. And she immediately told me, is this something that you've ever brought forward to your general practitioner, your GP? And I said, no. She's like, you know what? I'm not in a place to tell you anything otherwise, but I strongly encourage you to bring those examples that you've shared with me today, along with the words inattentiveness and indecisiveness, to your doctor. And so we ended that call. I think it was like maybe the third or fourth grief counseling call that I had with her. And I immediately went on to Google, as anyone would. Like, I don't know what these words mean. Inattentiveness, indecisiveness. Okay, I don't know, lady. Like, yeah, I really didn't know what to expect. But I put it in. And oh my gosh, when I typed in those two words into my Google search at that time, guess what popped up? ADHD. And for me, I freaked out. Like I yelled because never in my 34 years of existence on this planet have I ever heard that these were things associated with ADHD. Now, I was just very much thinking about the stereotypical symptoms of ADHD as it presents in terms of being hyperactive and things of that nature. But never once did I ever think that it had anything to do with being inattentive. And so I remember my partner was just in the other room, and he immediately came in, and he was just like, what's up? And I just, you know, I was just telling him, like, oh my God, I think I have ADHD. And he's just like, you know what? Like, why don't we take it one step at a time? Go to your doctor, talk to your doctor about it, and go from there. And so that's what I did. I talked to my GP, and I remember her just telling me, you know, I'm already aware that you are in the midst of heavy grief over the passing of your mother-in-law. So perhaps waiting a few months later to consider doing an assessment would probably be the best course of action, because you don't want it to be swayed by your current state of mind, which I definitely agreed with. But you know what? That only just gave me more time to do a deep dive into ADHD. And that's exactly what I did. For months, I pulled up articles after research after Instagram and YouTube video. Anything I could find on ADHD, I found it. And I read up on it. And by the end of those few months, and eventually I went back to work and I got back into the swing of things, I think it was maybe like nearing the fall that I went back to my general practitioner and I said, you know what? I'm ready. I'm ready to do this assessment. I just want to know, what is the difference behind going through the public healthcare system versus doing it private? And then also the pros and cons from her perspective of doing it online versus through a psychologist. And that's what I did. I ended up paying the money and getting the assessment done. And honestly, I shouldn't have had to pay for that assessment. The system is so flawed. Like, GPs can diagnose their patients, but most don't because of fear, bias, complexity. I really don't know. And honestly, it just made no sense, because the expectations on paper did not match my reality. Like, it literally says online that your general practitioner can diagnose you with ADHD. And I would go online, Reddit, and I would hear about how others get diagnosed through their general practitioner. But for some reason, mine didn't. And I also heard that from one conversation to another, from other people who lived in the same province as I, about their experience with getting a diagnosis. Like, why was I doing all this research? Like, having to put together, like, I really felt like I was putting together a business case to get this diagnosis or to even be considered as having ADHD. But you know what? Isn't that the woman experience in a nutshell? The Black woman experience? Not to be believed? And honestly, it made it seem like no one cared enough. Like, why was the default diagnosis depression and anxiety? Like, why didn't anyone think to go deeper? For crying out loud, it took a conversation with a Black grief counselor, mind you, to probe and ask me the right questions and push me in a direction to where I could discover for myself this information. And who really knows what else was said or not said behind closed doors? Because that's a whole other thing. But you know what? After all, I was the little Black girl growing up in public housing in a single parent household who strived at all costs to excel academically because I had to, as I wasn't trying to become yet another statistic, you know? I just knew I had to advocate for myself moving forward. Like, lucky for me, I've lived this life long enough. I've seen many things and I'm too educated to just give up on my pursuit of truth. So even before going back to my doctor to get her opinions on what assessment process I would take, I just wanted to be sure in my heart of hearts that I was making the right decision for me and my health to make that shift from taking one set of medication to another. And to be more specific, moving from an antidepressant to stimulant controlled substances. And so a lot of the, when I started looking into ADHD from like a scientific standpoint, a lot of the research also was saying how it was hereditary. It was very much encoded in your genetics, and the likelihood of you having ADHD and a parent having ADHD, like it's like 50%. Like, and so, you know, you could look at your family and almost track and see who else in your family has ADHD. Knowing that, I ended up doing 23andMe. I cross-referenced it with a lot of scholarly research and just double-checking, you know, if I carried the gene variants that a lot of research, was tying it back to. And that's how I came about this. That's what I ended up doing in terms of just determining for myself that maybe that this was the thing. Before I even went back to my doctor about what was the best course of action for an assessment, I also did some research as it comes to genetics and just understanding how it can show up in other places, like in other familial relationships. So either your parents or your aunts and uncles, like you can see it. Okay, you can tie it back. And so I've done my research from a genetic standpoint. I've done my research from a symptom standpoint, recalling upon my past histories and understanding me and, you know, how my performance has been at work, and then understanding like my relationships. I very much felt like I had ADHD. This was the one thing that very much was in alignment with everything that I've known about myself. So in fall of 2023, I went through with a psychological assessment with a psychologist, and we went through a series of questionnaires, a clinical interview, having an informant speak to their observations in different environments from work to relationships, as well as doing a number of different tests that would just cross-reference with the scores of other females in my age group to determine that I had ADHD. And so by the end of the process, I was diagnosed with subtype predominantly inattentive ADHD. And that brings me to why I even brought together this podcast. How did I come up with the idea to do this podcast? I very much was, you know, was in a state of I had to acknowledge that this was the diagnosis. I had to come to terms with what that meant for me in terms of why I did the things that I did in the past, and then what can I be doing a little bit differently just to help myself out. And I wanted to also just hear from other people who either had a late diagnosis or they suspect that they also have ADHD. But I also want to hear from people specifically who looked like me. As part of my research, I realized that not a lot of content was geared towards women, let alone women of color. And so I was curious, based on what societal norms are out there and stereotypes are out there associated with Black and brown women, how some of these symptoms can be lost, how they might be diagnosed as having something else when truly it is ADHD, and getting them the proper tools and resources to help them excel and thrive. I know for me, I'm still in a space and time where I can't necessarily say that I've accepted all of what has transpired over the past 6 to 8 months, because I'll be honest, like, that's literally the time frame that I'm working with and learning more about ADHD. But I know that in my years of existing on this planet, it is the one thing that makes the absolute sense. And after having such an extensive assessment done and having this report that is almost 10 pages long talking about me, it was so freeing for myself. It gave me more information on why I do what, like, who I am and why I do the things that I do. It gave me, it provided a label that made sense and allow me to find the right resources and tools for myself. So since this diagnosis, I have definitely looked into ways to go about treating it. And I realized that it's not a one size fit all approach that you take with addressing ADHD. It requires multiple angles. It requires a change in lifestyle of, like, you know, exercise, diet, because vitamins and minerals can impact that, sleep, understanding how talk therapy can support that, having strong systems of organization. For some people, even from a spiritual standpoint, can help with some of these symptoms of ADHD, as well as medication. And so I'm on this journey of exploring and learning more about what that looks like for me and the perfect blend, but also recognizing that it's not going to be a one-time set and done thing. It's going to constantly evolve. And then also too, why I did this podcast is because, again, there's not a lot of research about women with ADHD. There's not a lot of research about how it impacts them from with premenopausal. I don't even know what that is. I'm still learning that concept. Menopause, how does it impact pregnancy and having medication when you have ADHD and you're pregnant? In terms of puberty, in terms of hormonal imbalances, a number of things are not explored. And really, if I can gather enough voices to speak to people's lived experiences with ADHD, perhaps it may inspire those folks who are, you know, in the spaces to do research and studies. So then we can inspire the future generations coming up behind them, so then they can be diagnosed in time to get those supports. There is concrete evidence that early intervention makes a huge difference on how a person with ADHD lives life as an adult. So why not find ways and ways to encourage those minds and those people who are in those spaces to do more research on it, so then they can only share it back with others and educate them on how they can spot these symptoms. And so my call to action today is that in sharing my story, I hope it inspires you to share your story, either with myself and as part of this podcast. I'd love to build a repertoire of voices so then more can be done in this area. Whether I interview you as an anonymous guest or you'd like to be named, I can profile you. Or even just sharing your story online, as I will be honest with you, when you hit the hashtag ADHD, I get to see your face. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to draw parallels and see the similarities and things that we've experienced that perhaps can be compiled and shared back and can help other people identify it within their circles. So that's it. I hope you enjoyed hearing my story. And again, it's only within a small period of time that I get to share my perspective on having ADHD and my process with getting that diagnosis. But I know there's way more to be said. There's way more that can be explored and discussed a bit further, but I'll leave it at that. And that's a wrap on today's episode. Thanks for tuning in to learn something new as you help us grow and contribute to the online discussions around ADHD. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to Melanated ADHD on your favorite podcasting channels, and check out our social media accounts in the show notes. Until next time, take care and stay hydrated.